times, and actually, I mentioned education, I was the education editor. But the day after the towers came down, the investigative unit at the New York Times put together a team to try to figure out what happened, what the plot was, who were the people who did it, and so forth. A set of stories, and because I had been in the Middle East, the guy running the show, Steve Engelberg, who's now the editor of ProPublica, asked me to be one of two editors working with him and a team of reporters. So that's what we did, and it's the hardest I've ever worked. We worked every weekend and every day for 4 months.
And I assume it was emotionally difficult.
So it's a very interesting question. The day that the towers came down and I was sort of looped into the game, it was very very powerful for me to be part of it, because I it's a form of therapy in a way to start to look into something. And on some level, I feel that way about the Trump story.
So, talking about what you do now, how do you find, can you sort of explain for us what you do as a managing editor?
So I'm not the managing editor. I sort of manage a group of reporters, but in fact, I started out doing that, and we've now increased the team, and I'm not the only one doing it. So I'm really a member of a team. I'm not in charge of it. Well, we have a meeting every day of about 7 or 8 editors who are, not everyone does nothing but Trump, but you know, there's the Washington bureau chief and the chief content officer of the organization and a few of us who do investigative stuff. And we see what's going on. We also meet with reporters before it. We've got a bunch of longer term projects going. And we, you know, of course, about what a story that has just broken, right? So, for example, today there's a story from McClatchy that says that Michael Cohen, who was one of the lawyers in the Trump orbit, was his personal lawyer for a long time, mysteriously sold at a high price a bunch of apartments. And the idea of the story is that this is some kind of money laundering going on. So, I mean, I'm here, but I'm in email touch, so I'm sort of sending notes to the reporters saying, so what do we think of this story? And one of the reporters I work with, who knows a lot about how real estate works, thinks the story is quite half-assed, actually, and that it's not so much that he's made a lot of money now. He thinks that given the price per unit, the sale price of $10 million, which is what it was a year or two ago, is about right. And when he bought it for $2 million, he said he got the deal there. And probably it was the seller was in distress and he was able to get it, probably put some money into the place, and is now sold at an appropriate price. I don't think there's a story here, said he. So we spend some of our time doing that as well, right?
I think it might just be useful if you can just sort of summarize what it is your team is looking into.
Right. So we have sort of these overlapping teams, and we are, the Russia story is a big part of what we worry about. I have two guys who've done almost nothing but the Kushner real estate empire for the last 10 months. And they've made a lot of progress in figuring that out. I'm happy to talk more about that if you'd like me to now.
Well, maybe tell us a little bit more,
sure.
And then
okay.
We could go into the
That's
details.
That's fine. Then we are, you know, we've done work looking at Manafort. We did a profile also of Michael Cohen. We've tried to pick out some of these characters to see where it takes us. We've done work in Ukraine. And we've also, tried to look at the way that Trump has done business abroad, in the Dominican Republic, in the Philippines, in Azerbaijan, places where in Uruguay and in Panama, places where we sort of assume that to do business, it isn't all up on the up and up, and that possible violations of Foreign Corrupt Practice Acts would have occurred, try to see who has gone into business with, that kind of thing. So we've done a bunch of that. We try to stay, try to keep our sense of what the Senate and House committees are doing, what we can learn about the Mueller team. I don't know what you're being told, but I can tell you that the Mueller team does not leak at all, at all, at all. I mean, you know, when you read a story, you think, oh, I see Mueller's, no, it's not Mueller's team, believe me. They're very, very buttoned up, and it's about, it's lawyers and witnesses and other people who are leaking, where you can get information from. So that's broadly what we do.
And just to keep on that before we get into the details of the stories which we want to do, but I mean, was this something that was constituted during the campaign? I mean, was there a sense?
Team?
Yeah, was there a sense? No. So this was when he became.
This was after he was elected, and I was doing other stuff totally, by the way. I was doing Latin America. This idea arose among editors that here's a man who's a business person, who's in the White House, in the Oval Office, in a way that we've never had before, a huge amount of wealth, and who talks about wealth accumulation and so forth in a way that's, you know, our readers, this is what they do. So we should get serious about this side of his, of what he does. And a team was established, and I was asked to be involved, and that's what happened. It happened around November 15th, as I recall.
And is it maybe surprising that it wasn't done during the campaign? I mean, you had...
Well, I will say, so, and one of the reasons maybe I was asked is that a year earlier, within a few months of his announcing his candidacy, I suggested, I of all people, don't ask me, you know, these things happen when you're running or in the shower or something. We should take a look at Trump's business practices abroad. He says he's the great deal maker. Let's look at them. So I wrote a proposal. They gave me three reporters, and we spent about 6 months on it and produced a pretty good story, which for Bloomberg purposes got a lot of readers, too. I think it was around.
So when did it come out? When was it?
It came out in February of 16. Okay, and it was a kind of at 10,000 feet. I mean, it talked about his Scottish golf courses and Azerbaijan, and you know, it didn't nail him on anything, but it did make clear that he made a lot of what one would consider to be poor choices in business partners. There were a bunch of lawsuits against him. He was pretty brutal in dealing with, you know, there was a bunch of stuff that you read this, you thought, this is not a good businessman that I would particularly want to trust. That, I would say, is what you learned. And so we did do that story, but the idea of a team focused on it, no. And I would say something beyond that, Laurel, which is that all of the investigative reporting that's going on around Trump today should and does make me ashamed that there wasn't more of it going on when Obama was president.
Of Obama?
Yes, of anybody. Yes,
okay.
It should not be that we wait for this to happen before we rev our engines up like this.
And this will be the last one, the pre-presidency question, but do you think that, I mean, you talked some about, you did this story in February of 16, but do you think that the press was doing, paid sufficient attention to Trump's business dealings before the election? And if not, why not?
You know, I'm a little embarrassed in the sense that I don't have a very considered judgment of what the press has done. I'm not a real student of the press. I do it, but I haven't, like, examined what happened, you know, how much of his business came under scrutiny, whether it was inappropriate or not. I don't know the answer to it. As I say, we did, and we also looked at, I should turn my phone off, I'm so sorry. And we also looked at, you know, some of his other practices, and we looked at how corporate America was looking at him. I will say that the prevailing view until the night of the election was that he didn't have a chance of winning. And so it was kind of a little bit of a curiosity almost, right? I remember on election day, an Israeli journalist, because I spent a lot of time in Israel, Israelis always call me when they come to New York, I said, I want to come to the newsroom. And so I brought her around to Bloomberg Politics, which was a huge operation, as you recall. And she asked everyone, so who's going to win? And everybody, I mean, it wasn't even like, well, it was just like, couldn't have been clearer to everyone that it was going to be Hillary Clinton. So.
Do you think, though, that there's a lesson in that, that perhaps the media as an industry needs to, as you say, be a we need to be as new journalists, students of the press, so we need to kind of be analyzing ourselves so that that mistake.
That's a good question. Again. Maybe you know, it's sort of a second, almost full time job though. Mm. I mean, there are people whose beat is the media, right? In many news organizations. I don't feel like it's my job to worry about the CNN doing enough X. I think it's my job to worry about whether I'm doing enough X. So, to that extent, I don't agree with you. That is, you know what I mean. But sure, as an industry, we should be worried about whether we're doing a good job. And I mean, you know, it was a very strange victory. It was a very weird, narrow path to victory that was, you know, the likelihood was low, and it happened. Low doesn't mean zero, and that's what I think people misunderstood.
Yeah, so kind of switching gears a little bit, I just have a question about like Trump and Kushner and Manafort's business dealings and how that affects just the White House in general and like President Trump's role right now, like these prior business dealings being
well,
in the news.
The broad question is, we are fairly confident that the Russians interfered, sought to affect our elections, right?
Mm-hmm.
We know that they used various social media, Facebook-y, Twittery things to do so. We also know that the Trump campaign, I won't say brag, but proudly asserted that it did similar kinds of work, not interfering, they were campaigning, using social media, Twitter, Facebook, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that they had, there were all these stories about Cambridge Analytica that they had hired that said, you know, we have very sophisticated from PSYOPs stuff, we know how to do it,
mm-hmm.
and that's why we were able to intelligently go into the Rust Belt and make do stuff that the Clinton campaign wasn't doing.
Mm-hmm.
So what we want to know is, did these in any way meet, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question. So therefore, the relationship between Trump and Russia-related business is not incidental. It's important.
Mm-hmm.
Manafort, who was his campaign manager until he was driven out, but who was for several months, spent many years doing business in Ukraine for a pro-Putin party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, and we also know that Trump spoke highly of Putin and of Russia during the campaign in ways that Republicans never did, or it's just kind of weird, what was
mm-hmm.
that?
Mm-hmm.
And we also have random quotes from his son saying, you know, a lot of our money comes from Russians.
Mm-hmm.
We did a story, I don't think I sent it to you guys, but we did a story about a year ago, I mean, I guess it was not a year ago because the election was 11 months ago, but maybe 8 months ago,
mm-hmm.
looking at Trump World Tower, which is next to the UN,
mm-hmm.
and figuring out who owns the fancy condos, and
mm-hmm.
70% of them were Russian speakers,
mm-hmm.
okay? So he's done business with a lot of Russians over the years. We know he was in deep debt in the 90s, and we know that vast sums of money came out of the former Soviet Union. It was a big fire sale, basically, and a robbery of a whole bunch of these countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the money was put into real estate in this country, some of it into Trump real estate. And so these are questions that one naturally asks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you see, you know, Bloomberg is having, I mean, one of the things you kind of alluded to it before is sort of, you know, lots of people are chasing this story, right?
Oh God.
Both reporters and the special counsel and maybe congressional committees,
right.
Although that's probably a little bit less clear. So how do you decide what's your story to go
after? Yeah, that's a tough call. And we face that problem every day. In particular because a lot of the stories are forms of leaks out of Washington. And Bloomberg has not particularly stood out for its political coverage in Washington before now, so it's not filled in with a whole bunch of these committee types. And so we sometimes find ourselves running. So the argument we made to ourselves was that as much business as that we can, because that's what we know about, and let's look at that. So that's why we started to look at their business practices and their business, specifically the Kushner business. So with regard to Kushner, the argument was that, I mean, so briefly 10 years ago, in late 06 and early 07, the Kushner family company bought a building on Fifth Avenue, 666 Fifth Avenue. Until that time, for about 10 or 15 years before that, real estate was basically printing money. Everybody was making a ton of money in New York City on commercial real estate, and the Kushners were in New Jersey and Delaware and Maryland. They were not in New York City. They wanted to be. There's also a personal story of Charlie Kushner, Jared's father, having to going to jail for a tawdry family business. And so the desire to sort of start over and make a mark in New York was very powerful in the family. And to do so, they overpaid for this building. And not only did they overpay given the market at the time, but a year later the financial crisis hit and the market just collapsed. So they paid $1.8 billion for a building, only $50 million of which was theirs. The rest was borrowed based on sales. So they were sort of spinning their wheels, trying to keep their family company in good shape, dealing with this building, and we've chronicled a lot of that. And what we also know is that they were constantly trying, looking, they had this idea that if they were, one of the problems with the building they own is it's quite an old-fashioned, built in the 50s, low ceilings, not the big open plan that people want today. So they came up with this idea of a big fancy Zaha Hadid designed building. She died last year, but one of the great architects of our day. Billions of dollars, double the height, blah, 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 hotel, mall, big, big plan. And to do it, they needed a lot of dough. So they were going around trying to get meetings with rich people abroad, and no one had ever heard of the Kushners. They weren't getting any meetings. When the Trump campaign began to rise in the summer of 16, suddenly doors opened for them. They got meetings in Israel. They got meetings in South Korea. They got meetings in the UAE. They got meetings in Saudi Arabia and in China. And so suddenly they were, and exactly at the moment when the issue of conflict of interest should be most problematic. They're basically trading on their political power. So we wrote a lot about that.
And very well, I mean, I just, very well too. I mean,
that's
I think
nice
that, that describing, I mean, the particularly sort of the desire of the family to go from New Jersey apartment buildings
right.
to Manhattan, you know, I think it partially, it also, as other people have noted, kind of there's parallels with Trump's own story.
Absolutely.
But I think you present it in a way where it made a lot of sense what was happening and what the drive was.
Right.
It wasn't like I'm just gonna go spend
no,
a crazy amount of money
absolutely.
On this crazy building.
And then, you know, and then it, so meanwhile, so it's been very important to sort of illustrate what their situation is, because like Trump, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in the Kushner operation. And we wrote a story a week or two ago, I didn't send you, it was a story that said Vornado, which is the half owner of this building, is basically telling people in the building that this plan is dead. Okay, go ahead and start filling those offices because we're not going forward with that. The Kushners were horrified by our story. They put out a statement saying nothing's been decided. But then we get these vicious emails from their PR agency off the record. This is off the record. You're 100% wrong. 100% wrong. And you know, so I wrote back and said, look, you know, we don't want to be wrong. We want to be right. If we're wrong, tell us, we'll correct it, and we will, you know, can you answer these questions? No, you're just wrong, you're not worth talking to. So, you know, it's a pretty rough time right now between us and them, and we're not done.
Uh-huh. And just to be clear, so when we're talking about the Kushners, this isn't necessarily Jared.
It's not Jared, because
okay.
Jared divested himself of some of, he sold to his brother and father and mother, his share,
but obviously,
but you know,
right? Presumably, he cares somewhat about what happens to his mother and father.
Absolutely,
and brother.
That's the thing about this whole divestment business, mm-hmm. right? That is so not arm's lengthy about it. But it's also, you know, these families, that's how they operate. They're
families.
They're families. That's, and they believe in it.
Right.
And until they got into the White House, that's how it was all about making money and all about the family.
So if the Kushners end up defaulting and becoming bankrupt as a result of 666, will that have any implications on Trump or the presidency?
I mean, no, probably not. You know, I don't know, actually. It's a good question. An interesting question is what impact it would have on Jared, right? And you see, of course, to get back to the scandal question, we do know that Jared held meetings with Russian bankers, Russian ambassador, and we don't know what was said in those meetings, but we can't help but suspect that maybe you might want to lend us some money for this building came up. Okay, they say no. Maybe not, but that is what the conversation they were having with every foreigner they met, not with the Russians, right? So if that were to come out, then that would have a huge effect on the presidency. Would it lead to his being deposed? All, I mean, you know, the it's very difficult to get rid of a president. It requires essentially a political act, and at the moment. Those institutions, the Congress, are controlled by the Republicans, and I can't see them impeaching him.
And this might be hard for you to answer, and might require the kind of speculation you don't want to engage in. But just as you know, Kushner is, you know, he's in this son-in-law role. He's also supposedly, although I'm not sure I've seen any signs of it, but that would be another question,
right,
too. All these other
thing.
Portfolios, right? But then he also has this crushing weight, I would imagine, of trying to save the family's business.
That's been our argument.
So what is he doing these days?
We don't know. I mean, you know, there's not a White House that particularly is eager to share what it's doing with us, mm-hmm. us broadly, I don't mean Bloomberg. So it's not easy to know.
But you have a sense that he's, I mean, because we've heard about all of these portfolios, right? I mean, even today, the opioid thing, wasn't that his deal?
I don't know that. Is that what it said?
I mean, in the past, it was,
yeah,
he was given,
right.
That was part of his,
he was,
but I don't think he was anywhere on
he
that.
He was supposedly going to reshape the government, right? Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He's got a sort of entrepreneurial thingy to redo the government, and he's supposed to be doing Middle East. He also was supposed to be doing China. But he was going to go to China, he and Ivanka, this month, and they called it off, their visits. I don't know what that means. But I don't know exactly. The Saudi thing, we do know that he went to Saudi with the president in whenever it was, April or May. I think he's got a relationship with that crown prince. I don't know the answer to that.
Is it something that you were following, or is that maybe more be the politics?
It's a little bit more the policy, and we've been struggling with whether we should assign a reporter just to Ivanka and Jared, and we tried to for a while, and then she ended up switching to an editor role, and we haven't really dealt with it. And I don't know how to answer that. I mean, Bloomberg tends to be ambivalent about the political stuff, how much political stuff to write. You know, in terms of their businesses, up to more, they're clearer about it.
What would be the aim of assigning an editor to that particular beat, the Jared and Ivanka?
So no, the editor, she became an editor, but not for that beat. So she became, but a reporter to it?
Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, really what Laurel's asking is what you all want to know. What are they doing all day? People, we're told that they have these important dinners at their house, Friday night Shabbat dinners where they invite court goyim, right? And have them in for a Friday night dinner. And, you want to know what's going on. And they both are terribly, I mean, it is said that Trump trusts few people other than his, you know, the people he trusts most are these two. They've been given broad authority, so you'd like to follow what they do. We tried to get to sort of shadow her, and it wasn't easy to set up. It feels like it's an important part of what the government is up to, the spirit of the government, and then of course we're interested in their money. We're interested in what they're living off of. We're interested in what portion of what they live off of is taxpayer money, right? If they're constantly moving to Bedminster and then to their apartment in Manhattan, and these things, they have these kids and these nannies, so who's paying for these trips and how much do they cost? And what are they living off if the Kushners don't have any dough? And, you know, so what are they living off of? We don't know. We're interested.
When you say we, do you mean your traditional, like, business readers? I mean
we editors and reporters.
Okay.
I will say that, you know, Bloomberg is a strange place because we care about what's on our terminal, right? The paying customers, right? So, and the headlines are very important because they scroll and then the people click on it. Anytime you put either Kushner or Ivanka into a headline, you're gonna get many more hits than most anything else. There's enormous, enormous interest in our readers. Now, is it, you know...
Why would that be? I mean, that seems a little tabloidy for the guy who's on the trading desk, right?
There must be a little tabloidy thing, right?
But
it's just these people. I mean, it's like there's something like, what the hell is going on? You know, I don't know. I think that, like, all of us are, like, looking at these 35-year-olds who are running the country and wondering what the hell's going on here. I think.
So how do you get sources to talk to you about that?
Well, it's really... There's one simple answer, which is that a lot of people are angry, and so they do want to talk in Washington, okay? The deep state, as you've heard, does like to talk, up to a point. In Kushner world, where we're doing a lot of work, and our main reporter on it is a guy named David Kochanowski, who was a New York Times reporter for many years, and did New Jersey politics. And he knows these characters. Plays ice hockey. He's kind of a tough guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of a Jersey kind. He's from Buffalo, but okay. and he goes to bars and not. I mean, he does his job. Mm-hmm. So and then in Kushner world, there are a lot of people who think, you know, why are these people so rich? Why? What have they done to deserve that kind of thing? And why are they in power? I mean, people like to talk. It's why we have jobs.
Right.
People like to talk about themselves.
Yeah. Have you?
No, go ahead.
Have you ever worried just about Bloomberg's coverage in general, the amount of, like, sometimes anonymous sources being used in the stories, and whether or not readers question, like, credibility?
I mean, I know that's been a pretty big issue in recent years,
right,
for a bunch of news organizations. I'm a little bit old school on it. I'm not that worried about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, I trust myself, right? So when a reporter tells me, this guy was the chief financial officer until 2 years ago, and he stays in touch with so-and-so, and he had breakfast with Charlie, and Charlie told him, I take it at face value, but he can't be named, I accept it.
Right.
And so we figure out a way to do it, and then there are times when, like, and the guy said something so remarkable that we're not going to be able to rely on just his word.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that everybody needs to be named, I don't accept it.
Right.
I mean, I've been a sort of political reporter and doing intelligence work in Israel, no one's going to give me their names. I'm sorry. So I'm okay with not naming people. Mm-hmm. Of course, naming people is a good thing.
Right.
You know, we should try. Yeah. But I also feel like when people's names are out there, they're much more cautious. So what we want is the truth,
right,
not their names.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether our readers are worried about it. Mm-hmm. Are they?
Do you get pushback on that? And some, I mean,
you
I
have
some
to have permission, you know, source approval within, but I'm not aware. I mean, I've not gotten notes from readers saying, why aren't you naming people?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not.
Did Bloomberg ever, I mean, I know the Times has done it, and some other news organizations have gone through this period where either they said, you know, some of the news organizations either said, you have to have only name sources.
Really?
That they left.
They did?
Yeah, and they lasted about 3 seconds. Yeah, it was
crazy.
This would have been maybe 15 years ago. There was some, I don't know, something pushed them to that. But then the Times, as I'm sure you know, you have to have two. I mean, they started setting procedures and what editors had to do and what editors had to know.
Right.
Has Bloomberg gone through one of those phases?
It may have. I've only been there for less than 3 years, so I'm not sure. We do have rules, right? If you're going to have an anonymous source, somebody has to approve it. But, you know, that's
fine. Is that like you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so when you talk to
someone above you, like, there, we've had a couple. We had one story which said that Mueller's investigation is going way beyond Russia to businesses, Trump's business, and Kushner's businesses, right? And we, it really was based on one source. Okay, somebody within the Mueller orbit, shall we say? And we knew who it was, and we felt it was real, and the editor-in-chief said, okay, go with it. And it was one of the most successful stories, meaning like 2 million people clicked on it, right? That we've had in the last year. And it seems to have been true. That's good, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
No, it's clearly true. But I say clearly, but in fact, until Mueller lays his cards on the table, we don't know what's true.
What is the relationship between like your reporters and the Mueller investigation, the counsel?
We don't have one. I mean, they just won't talk to us. You know, we will put in the obligatory call, and they don't answer. We don't even know where their offices are. Nobody does.
So do you ever worry that perhaps you're both going after the same thing or the same?
Well, I don't mind that. That'd be okay. That would be good. That would be a sign that we knew what we were doing.
Okay.
Yeah. No. I mean, you know, we're not able to get Mueller fairness people to talk to us. You know, occasionally you get people who know them in their lawyer world who can give you a steer, and that's what we need.
You know, on the story that Mueller was going beyond,
yeah.
You got that, I think, got a lot of pushback from the White House, and Trump's lawyer say?
So they said they shouldn't. They
right.
didn't say they're not.
That's true.
No, I
that's
mean,
true.
It's my
no,
memory.
No, that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, they said
that's
this,
true.
If they're doing that, that's inappropriate.
Right.
That's what they said.
Right.
That
which, of course, is a way
mandate.
Of sort of saying that they are.
Well.
Or maybe that they should.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the
yeah,
other way to
they,
read
but
that.
But in other words, the pushback was, this is a scandal if they're doing it. But it wasn't, they're not doing it.
And has there been any more? I mean, at the time, with these cycles, they go so
yeah,
fast. So this seems like 5 years ago. I think it was a month
three or four
ago.
Months ago, right?
Not even that. But one of the things that the lawyer said, it was kind of part of the Trump, we're not, you know, if they go too far, meaning Mueller
yeah.
goes too far,
yeah.
maybe I'll do something. And
right.
it seemed to be part of like a threat.
Yeah.
But then it, has, have you heard more about
no,
it? No.
No.
So Mueller's just like, as far as you know, just doing his...
Going in 50 directions and yeah. That's what I imagine to be true. And you look at the dozen or 16 lawyers he has on his team, some of whom know a lot about Eastern Europe, some of whom know about money laundering. So the idea is that the sorts of things we're thinking about, they're thinking about.
And certainly that's true of Manafort. I mean, I think that was another story
yeah.
where you
I mean, maybe... most people think that the likelihood of an indictment of either Manafort and or Flynn is high, right? What that, is that going to affect the presidency?
What led you to Manafort? I mean, as your team?
Well, it's pretty clear, right? I mean, Manafort spent years in Ukraine. Manafort was paid millions and millions of dollars by pro-Putin political party in Ukraine. There's a man named Oleg Deripaska, who's a pro-Putin Russian businessman who went into business with Manafort. I mean, and Manafort was the campaign manager for Trump.
Although I think one of, to me again, and I know you don't, you know, and your job is not to make sure the press is doing its job.
Yeah, right.
It's your job is
but
to make sure
ahead.
You're
yeah.
doing your job.
Right.
But I think one of the mysteries about press coverage during the campaign was Manafort's campaign manager. Then this story comes out that he's on this ledger getting $10 million from pro-Putin forces in Ukraine.
Correct.
And then he gets fired, and then it disappears.
Right.
Right? Now we're off on Bannon and the alt-right, and yet that in and of itself seemed...
That's a fair point. I think that the Times, which broke that ledger story, did a big follow-up as well. I mean, the Times did win a Pulitzer for its, you know, ex-Soviet Union stuff last year,
mm-hmm.
and it was this kind of stuff. So, I mean, you know, was it enough? I mean, if the implication is, well, if the public had known, they wouldn't have voted for him, I suspect that's not true anyway. And, you know, our job isn't to defeat him, our job is to keep him honest, right? So, I don't know what to say. You may be right that. But he was, after all, then fired. So,
right.
And you know, there was a lot. It was a campaign. There was a lot going on. And you remember, he wasn't going to win anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people. That's kind of a theme here. Is that, in an odd way, a lot of what the press coverage was like was driven by the assumption he wasn't
right.
But that's not so crazy.
No,
except that it was wrong.
Right. But how did you get back to the Manafort story? So, you know, he's this figure, and then
right. So
but you went back at it.
Right, we did, and we weren't the only ones. So once we came to this question of what is the relationship between Donald Trump and Russian-related money and Putin, then Manafort is right in your face, right? We thought Michael Cohen would be an interesting person, too. His wife's Ukrainian. He's been back and forth. These attempts to build, a Trump Tower in Moscow. Trump held Miss Universe contest in Moscow in 2013, an odd place to hold it. There was $20 million spent on it. So there was a lot of Russia-related stuff going on, and we wanted to, we looked into all of it. I mean, I think I sent you one story about the relationship between Jared Kushner and Abramovich.
Yes.
And that story came about because of a reporter at Bloomberg who covers the art market, who's Russian-born, and who saw, Instagram pictures of a table at a gala with the two of them. And then we started to look and see what there was.
So that's how that story originated. That's really interesting.
Oh, social media is an incredibly useful source now.
You decide like what things on social media that you see might be worth pursuing? Like you said, that photo, I mean, that led to...
That led to people. There are now tools where you can search social media. Mm-hmm. In a weird way. So that led to an examination of all the photographs mm-hmm. of that gala. And then, and then it turned out that Ivanka and Jared were in Russia as guests of this Abramovich's wife. Mm-hmm. And so there were, Instagram-y things about we're having such a great time, that kind of thing, right? And then looking into the links, this Jewish museum that they were at a gala for, is kind of a Putin-blessed affair. So there's this weird relationship that Putin has to Chabad and that part of the Jewish community in Russia, which has links to here. Jared was at Chabad House at Harvard. The chief rabbi in Russia's nephew runs Chabad House at Harvard. I mean, you just sort of feel like you want to look at it all because you don't know.
Right. Yeah. That and I have people written about that Chabad?
There was one Politico story about the weird role of Chabad in Trump world, which was a great story that pissed a lot of people off, and there were things that weren't right about it, but that's the only one I know of. We've been on this thing for a while, but we're having a few issues.
Because, and let me just ask, this is maybe too insider-y, but I, I had thought that one of the things that Putin did was that sort of the Russian anti-Semitism which had never gone away, kind of reemerged, right? And
so
that some of the oligarchs who were targeted tended to be the Jewish oligarchs. And then you have this Jewish... I mean, I had no idea about this.
I would say the opposite is true.
Okay.
But in a fairly controlled and weird Soviet
body kind of way.
So actually, and it's a story we're working on, but we've got issues that are delaying it. Many Russian Jews say they've never felt free as they feel today in the history of Russia. Okay? And the oligarchs are all Jews too. Not just the ones he targeted, but the ones he rewards.
Uh-huh.
Very heavy Jewish. He personally, Putin, gave a month of his salary to the Jewish Museum. He's visited it several times. He's blessed it, and it's part of his empire. Okay? So that, and Abramovich and all these guys, they're all Jews, and they all have a relationship with Putin. So there's a weird thing going on, and they go back and forth with Israel, and Israel and Russia have good relations comparatively, compared to what they've had historically. Right, Netanyahu and his Lieberman, who's Belarusian, and these other guys actually come fairly often and are building political and commercial ties with Russia. In a way that, Russia was viciously anti-Zionist for years.
Right.
Viciously.
Right.
And that's just not true at all anymore. Right. Putin visited Israel in 2005 or 2007, sought out his high school teacher, found that she wasn't living well and bought her an apartment in the center of Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm.
That's
amazing.
So you're going to do that story?
Yeah, we're doing it. We're doing it. We're doing it. Don't steal it.
Okay. No, no, it's really, really interesting.
What's happening right now is that there is, because the United States is cracking down on RT, the Russians say they're going to crack down on American media. And so our story is, we're a little nervous about that. Elements of reporting of that story, we're holding off on it for a few weeks to see how this shakes out.
Does Bloomberg have like terminals in Russia? Is that like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But it also has a bureau. I mean, it has a very big bureau there.
But I mean, that part of the business is.
I mean, we must, and that must play a role in the conversation we're having. But no one has said to me, well, we're worried we're not going to sell terminals. They're just saying we're worried there'll be a crackdown on our reporters, so let's hold off for a little bit.
Do you ever feel though that like the fact that a lot of Bloomberg's revenue comes from the terminals? Do you feel that that's ever a pressure on your reporting or it impacts reporting?
That's a great question, and I don't have long history with Bloomberg, but there is no doubt that the answer is, unfortunately, to some extent, yes. There was a famous case from about 4 years ago in China. I would say that it's a little more true than any other news organization I've ever worked at. On the other hand, it's not overwhelmingly true. There is an element to it, and it comes from also the fact that the organization did not begin as a journalism organization, but as a financial data organization, and we have clients who pay stuff. And so it's not that we don't want to piss them off. That's okay. But, you know, there is at times a somewhat cozy relationship between the financial community and the reporters of Bloomberg who cover them. We did a story, one of the ones I sent you, about Blackstone and the Saudis and the Kushners, okay? The story we wrote said that the Saudis are investing $20 billion into the Blackstone infrastructure fund in this country. The Saudis have promised to buy $100 million of American arms that Jared was personally sort of making that work before they made their trip, and that the Blackstone is a major lender to the Kushner. And this is all worth talking about in one pot. And the Blackstone people went nuts. They insisted on a phone call with me after we published and said, we've never been treated this way by Bloomberg. And you know, Steve Schwartzman was the co-chair, co-founder of Blackstone. You know, he's supposed to be at one of your events. I'm trying to keep him on schedule. I'm telling you. And I said, I'm really sorry. And I mean, it went away. But so the fact that they feel they can talk to us that way, there must be some occasional coziness.
But did it change what you reported?
Did
it change what you reported?
Well, the story was already out.
We didn't send any corrections.
There was nothing. No, they didn't demand it. They couldn't. That was the thing. It was the tone that made them so upset. There wasn't anything factual.
Okay.
And you know, there were people who didn't like the story. Not just there was a. Heard that there was someone at Bloomberg who said, I would never put my name on that story. It was filled with innuendo. I mean, look, I don't know what to tell you. You know, these things are complicated. It's complicated because really the role of all these places is to make money. So if they're making money, it's like, no, that's not an indictment of them. But, you know, and so they're all in a big, like, trip together, and well, that's like how it works, right? So, but on the other hand, once you start entering, I mean, Steve Schwartzman is the head of the president's Council of Economic or whatever it's called, advisors. So once you start entering governing, then it gets complicated. And it should get complicated. They sort of argue, no, it's not complicated. Our job is to say it is.
Do you feel, I mean, is there, so, I mean, there have been so many, not just yours, but lots of people have been looking at these kind of conflicts of interest.
Absolutely.
And yet, I'm not sure they've gotten too much resonance. I mean, it's hard to judge that.
The country doesn't seem to care.
Right. That's kind of what I was
driving.
Yes,
that's true.
And so, I mean, this might get to sort of how you view your audience and what you think you're doing, but, I mean, do you just see it as you lay it out and that's the important thing?
That's kind of how I see it. Yeah, I can't see any other way to do the job, right? I can't, in other words, like, we'll do a story that's strong conflict of interest, and people say, well, nobody cares, why are you doing it? I said, that's what I do for a living, because that's our job. And I also think that if there really was fundamental wrongdoing, these accumulated things will make a case eventually, right? And our job is to expose wrongdoing. If people are unimpressed that it's wrong, okay, but.
Although sometimes it's and this maybe gets kind of the work you do at Bloomberg, sometimes it's the little things, right? Not, you know, the big complicated things, but the, you know, the 300, I mean, this is not little, but the $300 million contract to Puerto Rico. I mean, people can kind of get that in a way that they may, or, you know, price flying all over the country.
Right.
I mean,
that was a good story.
It was a good story, and yet maybe it's not as fundamentally important as getting contracts with Saudi Arabia. So, I'm not even sure what I'm asking.
Right. But, well, I mean, you're trying to put yourself in my shoes and say, so how do you deal with the sort of way it's shrugged off? And I just move on. You know, I just feel like, you know, we have to establish what's a legitimate story, and then we write it and we move on.
It may even come out of, I mean, we share a Connecticut background, although you haven't, I've lived there more recently than you have, but, you know, our former governor, John Rowland, was sort of famous for doing these kinds of deals and with some questionable contractors, but what did him in was not that, it was putting using government money to put a hot tub in
You're right. You don't know.
And sometimes it needs to be something that people just like understand and can glom onto in a way. But I mean, I'm not saying you should do hot tub
stories. No, I understand. But I mean, if we had it, we'd do it too.
Yeah. Do you, when you write those stories, are you writing for the Bloomberg audience who you think of as sophisticated business types, or are you writing for...
That's always an issue. Even at the New York Times, it was an issue. Who is your audience? And you try to sort of thread the needle between people who know stuff and a broad, educated audience. So a lot of our stories, of course, to go on the terminal, but we also put them out on the web, right? And the terminal, you know, is never... If you have 10,000 readers on the terminal of any story, that's enormous. But out in the world, we could get 1 million readers. So I think of the world, I mean, of course, we need to take care of our terminal readers, but I don't see them as our primary audience for these stories. The people who pay for the terminal, they want to know the price of soybeans and chili yesterday. They get that.
And the Ivanka story.
But the Ivanka story is dessert for them, and they're not paying to get the Ivanka story.
Right.
So, therefore, I think of the rest of the world for the Ivanka story.
How do you, navigate your stories to appeal to, the rest of the world, if you're saying that?
Well, so that, because the answer is that's fundamentally where I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. I look at the general reader. The sort of typical New York Times reader, the typical Bloomberg reader, to me, is the same person. Mm-hmm. And I don't... I mean, the way we do it, if it's a particularly technical story, like, you know, there are mezzanine loans for this, is to make sure that it makes sense to you if you're not an expert, right?
Yeah.
And also to look for the telling detail, right? And what the person was wearing and what they ate for breakfast, you know, all those things that give narrative appeal to a story. And so one of the things that's interesting about Bloomberg is sometimes you have people who know how to, you know, tell you about mortgages, but don't really know how to write in that way, and so that's where I come in. Since I don't understand anything about mortgages, so if you can explain it to me and I can understand, I can help you write it in a way that will be appealing.
Mm-hmm. And I also noticed just from looking at the stories you sent us, a lot of the stories have like graphs or
there's a lot of that going on.
Some data in there.
They have some very fine data visualization team, and they've done some great work. And actually, it's not very. I'm not that focused on that stuff myself, but a lot of people are, and it's great.
Yeah. I think that was helpful for me as a reader,
that's
as a
great.
Consumer, too.
To see those things?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why you're not alone. Apparently, I'm alone. Yeah, because I look at them, I don't know what they're doing. Give me words. But no, it's great, and it really matters to people. I actually, the big Kushner story that I sent you, I was at a dinner, and some lawyer was starting to talk to me. She didn't know that I was involved in that story. She said, the most amazing graphics, and I'm going, that's the story. And she said, it really made a difference to me to have those graphics. And I said, well, that's of course why we do it.
Is we can do a few more here and then we'll open it up. But I know it seems as if that Bloomberg is trying to get into the conversation more, you know, on the cable shows, and I mean, what is that right, and what's being,
You know, I don't,
and why is that important?
So it's actually a fairly secretive company. I don't know what it wants for itself. It doesn't communicate internally very well, and if that's the goal, they have not shared that with us.
Okay.
But it does seem that way. I think you are observing something that's real. And I think that, you know, Mike Bloomberg had this very brilliant idea 30 years ago, whatever number of years ago it was, to do these, to create data that available to traders, specifically on commodities that he knew something about, that weren't available to everybody, and make them available for a price, obviously, but that you could make a lot of money on, right? And then to beat everybody else doing it when competitors got in. Then he set up a news service to go with it, because he was paying AP and Reuters to run their service over his terminals. Once that was established and several hundred thousand people were paying $20,000 or $25,000 a year, and you're bringing in $9 billion in income, then I think, you know, then there's the larger question, well, so, you know, do you want to be part of something larger? And I think the answer for many people was yes. There remains a tension in Bloomberg between keeping those 300,000 people who pay you happy and talking to the world, right? So, because those people, if they say, well, you're getting it for free, why am I going to pay for it? Then you have a problem. So they're constantly trying to figure it out. So they'll say, okay, we'll put it on the terminal for an hour before anybody else gets it. So now, if you look online, the bottom of every story, it says before here, it's on the terminal, right? So this is an idea of getting people to continue to be loyal to the terminal. A lot of the terminal loyalty is not to, has nothing to do with what I do. It's not about these news stories or these feature stories. It's about, as I say, foreign exchange rates and so on. And Bloomberg also established itself as a kind of back office communication system for the financial world. People send emails to one another over Bloomberg. Someone in Singapore, someone in Brazil like to communicate via Bloomberg instant chat or whatever it's called. And so there are a lot of sticky things that keep the clients there. But there remains a question about what your business model is. And I think that the answer right now is that it is you keep that system going, but you spread your brand. At a public service. I think that Mike Bloomberg is a public service oriented guy. And also because one day you may want to buy a terminal subscription, right? So if you know that Bloomberg is a trustworthy news source, then when you become interested in finance, then maybe you'll, I mean, that's as far as I can see how it works. And there may be, there's some advertising, there's TV, there's radio, you know, there are other sources of income apart from the terminal, but the terminal accounts for 95% of its income.
It was just because you mentioned Michael Bloomberg. We were wondering, we were talking about this earlier, how Bloomberg would have covered Michael Bloomberg had he ran for residency.
Oh, God. It would have been a huge crisis for the news organization. Because he's a very brilliant guy and very visionary, but he has some quirks. And one of his quirks is we don't cover ourselves. So Bloomberg has a billionaire list, the way Forbes does, and he's not on it. Okay? He refuses to be covered by his own company. So I don't know what we would have done. Obviously, they would have had to figure something out, because, I mean, excuse me.
and then if he became president, it's
well,
like, well,
God knows. I mean, you know, he was mayor, and I wasn't there. And, you know, they covered the city. So I my guess is that there's a lot of winking and nodding, frankly, you know. So do I think that Mike Bloomberg, who, you know, kept arm's length from his business the 12 years he was in City Hall, never asked anything about what was going on in the business? Seems kind of unlikely, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Wait, and was it in a blind trust? Did he do that? Or?
Supposedly. But what does that mean? Yeah.
Well, more than having your family run it.
I guess so. Yeah, that's true. But you know that when you're done in government, that's your money, and you want it to be making more money. So, anyway.
One last question I'm going to ask, and then I'm going to open up. Did you guys do the story about Don and Eric and how they were running the Trump organization?
Yes. So that's an example. Yeah, and I edited that story. That ran in Business Week. Sort of the way they're, what they're doing with the Trump organization, exactly. And this sort of weird down market Mississippi thing, daiquiri making contest.
Mic.
I think if we move the mic there.
Yeah, we can move the mic there.
Move the mic there. And you guys will. Oh, it's heavy.
It's stable. Just right here?
Maybe in the middle, so they will pick up everybody as we're doing. And then, Natasha, if you have trouble hearing,
I'll move it around.
Okay.
So, I was actually going to ask about Bloomberg and Michael Bloomberg, sorry, but had already asked that, so never mind. My question sounds like a joke, but it's not. Do you guys have like a one of those crime web kind of things?
Oh, you mean like a big chart where we follow it? We don't. We keep talking about how we should, but we don't.
Like not even like an electronic one to keep track of
who
everyone is?
No, we do have it. That's a good point. We do have electronically a bunch of lists, and we do have like lawyers and we do.
Okay. I was just curious.
Stories we're working on, stories that have been greenlit, stories that have been proposed, stories that have been published. These are all located in one place. Yes.
Okay. I was just wondering how you kept it straight.
Yeah, well, not very well, but that's how we do it.
So my question is, you said, gave us an interesting tease a while back. You said, we're not done yet.
Yeah, right. We're doing more Kushner stuff before the year ends.
Can you elaborate on that without violating your trust?
I would say that I'd be very upset if what I said somehow yielded something, a competitor getting to the story before my guys finish writing, right? So I don't want to say much. I would just say that we are continuing to look at the nature of their financial empire, real estate empire, and are skeptical of its size. And again, it isn't gonna bring down the presidency, right? It isn't really about Trump. But it is about, this guy who's pretty significant, and why we believe there are motivations for them to be looking for money abroad, and particularly their use of this EB-5 system, which is to, if you're a foreigner and you're willing to spend $500,000 to invest in a program in this country, then you can get a visa to come live here.
And did you cover some of their slumlord activities?
So that was a great get by ProPublica that we did not do.
Yeah.
McGinnis, I think, is that Ellis's name? The guy, ProPublica did a great story. It appeared in the Times Magazine about their slumlordy stuff in like Maryland.
And there's a lot of stuff in Boston, too.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, Cambridge, yeah.
So we've not done it, but not, we would have loved to, but we didn't.
At a time in which public confidence in the media is, some could say, at an all-time low, and when you talked earlier about using anonymous sources to get information, how do you reconcile getting information from anonymous sources while retaining public confidence in Bloomberg? How do you thread?
To me, the test of a story is, does it hold up? Is it true? And if it is, if you learn stuff because people are willing to come forward and not give their names because they're afraid for their jobs, they're afraid for their safety, I think this is something people can understand.
right? For example, you're doing a story about a cruel boss, and you go talk to employees, and they are still working there, and you want to learn about their life under this boss, they give their names, they will get fired. We have to, even if, I mean, I've been in a situation where I've talked to a field worker where he gives me his name, and I realize if I print his name, he's likely to be fired. He doesn't realize from giving me his name. He's not a sophisticated person who says, hey, this is off the record, or I'll talk to you in deep back right now. He says, you know, my name is Juan da da da, and then this is what happened to me, and so I protect him. I mean, I don't mean to be patronizing about it, but I feel like there is a risk to him that he didn't know what the rules of the game were. So I don't feel that anonymity is the end of all credibility. I just don't feel that way. And I don't feel that the skepticism toward the media in the public is related to that problem. I mean, first of all, I think that the public's attitude toward all institutions is gone way down. There is very little faith in anything, little faith in teachers and cops and priests and doctors. I mean, you know, there is an incredible amount of bad faith in our society today, and I don't think it's because we're using anonymous sources.
I'm going to ask a follow-up on anonymous sources, even though I said I wasn't going to ask another question. But, you know, Sessions has been saying a lot about, and certainly Trump has been saying, we need to crack down on leakers. And have you been feeling any of that pressure particularly? I mean, because the danger with an anonymous sources is that they might make you reveal who those sources are. I mean, that seems to be where...
In court, you mean?
Yes.
Well, but that's a fairly rare event. And you're right, there's a risk. And then people go to jail for refusing to name their sources. And we have felt, absolutely, and one of the problems of the electronic age we live in today is that it's really impossible to have a phone call that's anonymous today. I mean, you know, especially from an office, everything is clearly, they can follow everything. So it's quite hard to reach people in government sometimes. They will not answer their calls if it's coming from a news organization. So yes, we felt it. It's hard.
Granted, did you have a pop-up? I'm sorry.
I did have a follow-up to the anonymous sources thing. So you don't seem to think,
are there data on this? Are people saying I would believe the media more if they named their people? I mean, I haven't paid enough attention. I'm not a media critic, but it just doesn't seem to me the main issue.
I understand that.
Okay.
So my follow-up question is, what do you think attributes for low confidence in the media these days? Is it a combination
of things? I did say to you that it's not just the media that
right.
has lost the faith
that.
Of the public. I think that we live in a fairly sour age. I think that there is a kind of fake wisdom afloat, which says, you know, skepticism and cynicism are signs of intelligence, and therefore it's all crap. Everyone's lying all the time, right? And I don't think that's true. And unfortunately, I think that we have elected someone who is famous for his lies, and therefore it sort of contributes to the idea that that being precise is not important. I think it's a sign of our times that he was elected, a sign of our times that people are not upset that he's talking the way he talks when he manifestly violates the truth day in and day out. And you know, I don't have a great answer. I do think that we sometimes falsely think that the last 50 years was sort of the way to judge life. And actually, I think it was probably a very rare moment in American history when there was a kind of a consensus. There were three networks, there were main papers, there was there was an incredible amount of wealth in this country, a post-Second World War, and time of peace and prosperity, relatively speaking. The rest of the world wasn't knocking on our door. The Chinese were, you know, off. Nobody was really challenging our supremacy. And so it was a time, and especially if you were white and male and heterosexual, it was a time when pretty much anybody could do well
if you fit into those categories, right? So if you were very smart and an engineer, do well. If you were just a regular guy and you wanted a job at a factory, you were going to get paid your $17 an hour and be able to have a car and a boat. And life felt good for people in this country, for the majority of people in this country, who, as I say, were white and male and heterosexual, or not a majority, a large plurality. And so, and that has gone away. And there's a lot of anger about it. That's my sense.
So you think it's more of a societal problem as a whole?
I do.
Do you think it could get better? Or could it get worse before it gets better?
I think it could get worse before it gets better. I do think that, yes. Obviously, I think it could get better, sure. And I also think that, I'm also, the gap between the richest and the poorest has gotten so terrible, but on the other hand, a lot of people in this country and in the world live materially well off lives compared to what was 100 years ago. That's not what they're comparing themselves with. They're comparing themselves to people they see on TV who have huge mansions. So in many ways, life is better. I don't think it's worse for most people, but that's not how they feel.
So one thing that we were talking about earlier, we kind of got on to how a lot of this stuff with like Kushner and Ivanka, it feels like almost tabloid level, material. How as an organization like Bloomberg, how do you sort of bridge that gap when you feeling like sometimes you have to report on that kind of stuff, but at the same time trying to maintain this air of this kind of professional voice and this professional kind of credibility where you don't want to breach that level where you're just doing like pure tabloidy stuff?
I don't think we've really descended to any pure tabloidy stuff, to be honest, right? So I guess what I'd say is we've simply avoided it. I think when Laurel said that there's a tabloidy side to it about what people click on when you put Jared in the bunk, it's that there's a kind of a gossipy interest in these young, rich, handsome people who are running the country, right? It isn't necessarily, I wonder what our policy is going to be toward the Middle East. It's like, what's Jared up to, right? And so in that sense, it's tabloidy, but it's not quite the way you're using the word, I think, right? We're not writing about their love life. We don't, right?
Yeah.
We don't do that.
Right.
Although, and this is not to say it's tabloidy, but I think one of the things that was so intriguing about the story you did about the Jewish Museum is the notion that these social connections are also business connections, which now are also political connections,
correct,
right? So I don't think it's unimportant that Ivanka at least says one of her best friends is Rupert Murdoch's ex-wife, right?
That's right.
That this circle,
that's right,
and drawing those it's hard to draw those distinctions.
It can be, but again, I don't think it descends.
Right.
I
agree.
But
agree.
You do have sort of like, so at the U.S. Open, you have Dasha and Wendy, and do we care? We only care if we think it's part of some pattern.
Although I think in that story, even though I really like that story,
yes,
I'm not, and I don't think it was tabloidy.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure.
It told us all that much.
But I'm not sure.
Right, I'm not sure either,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah.
I can tell you this, that when we approached Jared's spokesman about the question we asked was, did Jared and Ivanka, in their security clearance forms, mention the relationship to Dasha and Roman Abramovich, right? So the guy says to us, well, we don't tell you what's on the security clearance forms. And I said, we can FOIA. He says, you'll never get anywhere FOIAing that. No one's ever gotten anything on that, okay? But he said, I'm willing to ask them whether they put it on there. Because the language on the form says, anyone you've had a long-standing relationship with, I can't remember, we put it in the story, what the language is. And he came back to us and he said, I'm going to tell you, but you can't attribute it to me, that it is on their forms. They did put it on their forms, not the first time, but when they came back and they had to, when they had to revise their forms. So we put that in the story, and we got a note from Nunes, the Senate, the congressman's staffer, saying, we've not been able to get anything about the reforms. Where'd you get that? Can you help us? Right? I know this is a little weird, writing you as a journalist from Congress, but we know nothing about those forms. Can you help us? So I'm just telling you how, so you know.
Why aren't those subject to FOIA?
It's just that you're not going to give it. They're not going to, you know, these are spooky things. These are things having to do with, this, you know, with national security, right? I'm just, that's what he said.
Yeah.
Hello.
This is kind of like a question on media ownership. So.
On what ownership?
Media ownership, like big conglomerates owning, like Bloomberg.
Yes.
Being an example. So the ex-prime minister of Australia on a Reddit AMA, he claimed that Murdoch owning Fox was one of the reasons Trump became the president. It's one of the reasons Brexit happened. Do you think this is a growing trend? And like, how do you think this will affect politics in the future? You yourself mentioned if Michael Bloomberg ran, it would have been a sticky situation for y'all. So where do you see the future of this going?
I mean, part of the problem with my answering it is that I don't have any expertise on this question, right? I mean, this would be like our sitting at a bar and you're saying, are you worried? And I'd say, yes, maybe I'm worried. But I really don't know whether it's true what the Australian Prime Minister said.
I mean, I don't want to.
No, I understand. But the truth is that Fox was not crazy about Trump as a candidate, specifically. Now, it's true that Trump is very Fox-like, and a lot of the stuff that, you know, the sort of sentiments that are manifest on Fox are Trumpian. But on the other hand, they're also responding to something. They're not just creating something. They're responding to a mood in the country. You're asking if I'm worried about the conglomeration of media. Yes, it's reason to, yes, there are reasons to be concerned about it. I mean, it's expensive to do right, and you don't want, you know, four rich guys owning the media. Yes, it's a legitimate concern. I will say that the arrival of, you know, the internet has, in some ways, it has ruined our economic models for how to make money as newspapers and so forth. On the other hand, it's opened everybody as an expert, right? Everybody's a journalist, and some people really are, even if they're not, right? So in a lot of ways, right now, although the media are all in trouble, if you want to know what's going on in another country, you can read all their newspapers online a lot of times for free and learn a lot more than you ever could historically. So it's not all bad what's going on.
I had a question about journalists and social media. I know that social media, as it's become a larger part of our lives, for journalists, social media has kind of moved from their personal life more to their public professional life. And I'm wondering if for your journalists, do you have a social media policy, and where do you think, or what do you think social media's role is within the newsroom?
Those are good questions. There must be a policy. I don't know what it is. I do see my colleagues tweeting and putting things on Facebook that I'm not happy about. I think that they're exposing their own views too much. I don't use social media except to promote whatever story I've edited or written. I don't put my wife's birthday on it. It's not like I'm above it. I just, you know, I'm a little old. I never really got into it, and I just don't. And
right.
Also, we talked earlier today, not at this session, but about when I was the Jerusalem correspondent, I was under a lot of pressure, a lot of attack for both the left and the right, pro-Israel, pro-Palestinian. And so my desire was to maintain a relatively low profile. And so therefore, and it was around that moment that social media exploded in 09, 10, and I never got into the habit. I do think that, you know, there are the younger reporters, and some of them not so young, really do use social media very intelligently. First of all, is what we were talking about earlier, which is that it's a great tool for reporting, right? You
right.
can learn a lot about people, if you really an enormous amount, right? If when someone shoots people, you go to their websites and their Facebook pages and stuff, you learn stuff about people pretty fast. But also, you know, sometimes you don't have a whole story, you just kind of want to tweet out a thought, and it can be a problem, but it can be great, too. And so you do see some of that happening. They have developed something in Bloomberg called The Blast, which is a little long. It's like 200 or 300 words. It's not fully developed as a story, and you just kind of... So one day I was... I did a blast. It was very exciting. I'm trying to remember what it was. It was... Oh God, it had to do with Israel and Trump. And oh, I remember what it was. So after Charlottesville, right, there was a lot of Jewish anger that they didn't sufficiently come down. You know, that Trump said too many nice things about the marchers, right? So I, because of my time covering Israel, when I have idle time, I tend to look at the Israeli websites and read them. And wrote a note to a colleague at Bloomberg saying, you know, I've noticed that basically every single newspaper in Israel is attacking Trump, despite the fact that Trump is seen as pro-Israel, for his stand on Charlottesville. She goes, that's a blast! I got a little blast. So I had to, they only developed the blast like 4 days earlier. I don't know what a blast is, but I'm glad you're happy. But so I had to do a kind of, you know, I basically wrote a, and it was 4 or 5 p.m. So the Israeli media, the Israeli bureau was asleep already. So I couldn't, because originally I said, I'll tell them to do it. They said, no, you don't. So I wrote a 400 word story saying, blah, 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 blah. So, and you know, and it, on our little terminal, got a lot of readers, actually. So, you know, I'd say that it is a complete part of our life today, your life, not mine, but, and it's very important. And of course, the, you know, this incredible thing going on, which is this interference and these false accounts. I mean, I heard the other day that something like 30% of Twitter accounts are bots. Some huge percentage aren't real.
Right.
So, I see like Facebook and Twitter, and I think of it, to me, this moment reminds me a little bit of 1969 with airplanes. Like, we'd all just walk on airplanes, there was no security, and then they started like killing people and hijacking them, and a whole industry had to be set up to protect the system that we took for granted. And I think that, you know, it could be that in 15 years, Facebook won't exist, but something, you know, like TWA is gone, but something like it, far more regulated, will come into existence. I don't know, but it seems to me inevitable, because I think there's a lot of mucking around and no regulation, and that's a problem.
Right, although here we have a First Amendment, which makes the regulation piece of it more difficult.
It does make it more difficult. I agree with you, but, you know, on the other hand, if you're... Yes, it does make it more difficult.
And I'm not even taking an advocacy position on it.
Absolutely right.
So you said that you are not really a media critic. Your job is just to make sure that, like, your team and Bloomberg is doing well. Do you feel like there's anything your team or Bloomberg is missing or not doing so well that could better?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we're not the stars of the show here. I think there's been a lot of fantastic work by the New York Times, by the Washington Post, by McClatchy, by BuzzFeed, by Newsweek, Daily Beast. I mean, we lose out on stories all the time. And what can I tell you? Yes. I can't think of a systematic thing like. If we did X better, it would, but you know, there are people doing better work than we do at times, absolutely. And we need it, you know, it's a motivation to do better, which is a good thing. On the other hand, I try to take a calm view of it, which is we're not the only people out there doing this, and it's inevitable that others will get stories that we don't get. You know, we are. Because of the history of Bloomberg, they sort of blew up the national security team in Washington 2 years ago. So national security is an important part of this element, and we don't have good sources in national security. So we either have to hire more people in that game, or we have to get better at it.
Then why don't you?
Because I'm not in charge. We talk about it a lot.
Uh-huh.
We talk about it. you know, it becomes this sort of thing, well, it's not our primary issue, you know. Yeah.
Well, the business stuff seems like it just,
yeah,
it makes
right,
more
right.
sense.
They're kind of, that's what they're most comfortable with.
Hi. So I want to ask a question that actually came up in a previous Media Watch class with Alec Thompson from Vice. And it's that to the extent that, whether it's Donald Trump and his own sort of native, you know, press genius, or just his bombastic character, or the people that he surrounded himself, the candidate and now the administration seems to have gamed a pre-existing version of the press that whether willfully or not, there's almost like an act of misdirection that keeps our eyes trained on, and it sort of relates to the tabloid question, but I hear you, like, I don't necessarily think that most stories about, you know, Kushner and Ivanka Trump are tabloid or sensationalistic. I think they're legitimate, grist for the mill. But I guess the instance where I felt it was stark was with the second, Gold Star family fracas, which it seemed to me that right at the point when, the GOP is very much behind closed doors, getting ready to jam a decade significant tax reform, sort of down the throat of Congress, suddenly it's making A1. These stories about the, and it just seems like I get why in an edit budget meeting they would say, yeah, we're going to need something, let's even put it on, let's give it 30 column inches and put it on A1. But it seems like this, like it is an instance where this, where we're being, because the system is what it is, our eyes are all shifting to Trump's left hand, while with his right hand he actually does something which is going to affect economic policy for many years to come.
Look, I think it's a very legitimate thing to say, and I think that there's something inherent. It is true that he's a genius at handling the media and manipulating it, but it's not just that. There are certain rules to our game that he is now constantly violating, and the act of violating them feels like a big story, right? I mean, how is it possible that the President of the United States, like, can't control his, you know, his sort of screw you back, you know, his no, mean that, no, you. And isn't it a story that the President of the United States, well, yes, but as you say, yes, it is, but on the other hand, he's about to declare war in North Korea. Are you not worried about that, too? So in theory, you try to do both, but you can't. It's such a central part of the journalistic culture to kind of watch the main person and how he acts that to not do it would be bizarre. I mean, and that occurred during the, and again, I don't have any greater expertise than you guys. I feel like you have more. You're studying journalism. I'm just doing it. And I say this really just as, you know, not as someone who's examined it very closely, but during the campaign, this came up a lot. I mean, and Hillary, in her book, attacks the New York Times for giving Trump too much sort of space, right? And that was a big thing, that Trump was kind of dominating the media in those months before the election. And, you know, and you were sort of, the media were kind of yielding to his nonsense, right? But the fact is that this guy has come from nowhere. He beat 15 other candidates. He's then, and now he's, and how do you not report it, right? How do you not be amazed by it? How do you not, like, whoa, so what does this tell us? And it does tell us something about where we are as a society. That's worth focusing on somehow, too. I mean, you know, I would say the paper I read most closely is the Times. They're able to put that and the tax on the front page, right? It isn't either or, to be fair. So, and I think that's a legitimate choice. I think Trump's behavior is a really important story because we don't know how to distinguish between his left-hand movement and what he's actually going to, where that this button it's going to push. So we don't. We can't tell. You know? There's this sort of constant debate about a guy like this. Is he a genius? Or is he just like a floating id? Right? And it's impossible. I don't know the answer to it.
It's the Chancy Gardner conundrum.
Right. But I mean, you know, he is, I do, you know, I've read a couple books about him, and when he did The Apprentice, you know, others tried to do it, and it's like, took off. People love it. He answers something. There's some common, his personality, his style, is some mix of things that it's like, you know, a fire you can't take your eyes off of, and have to come to terms. Yeah.
You were talking about how Trump kind of is violating a lot of rules that have seemingly been unspoken for the last 30 years and kind of just assumed this is how we operate in media. At what point when does it get to the point where the media starts to say, hey, you're violating these rules and that's unacceptable? And like, can there be a response?
It's being said all the time.
Well, so I guess more what I mean is does more get written about how this is unacceptable? Like does more of an emphasis get put on that at some point, or does it just continue to keep, like, there's a presence, but it doesn't ever seem to be emphasized in the way that, because it's so sensational, you think it would.
It's so funny you say that. I mean, you know, to me, as a reader of the New York Times, and again, that's the main thing I look at every day, I feel that the paper has gone way out in basically saying this guy is horrible, he's a liar, you know, he's a shame to this country. I mean, that there is not that sense of, well, is the president, you have to take, no. There is very much a feeling of a leaning into, not just on the editorial page, but throughout the paper of, you know, we're going to tell you that that the guy who's the president right now is a huge problem. And I've never seen it. And also, I'm not in the newsroom anymore, of course, at the Times, but I can tell you that having been there during George Bush and during Obama, it was very much understood that it was inappropriate to express your view on what you thought of the man or his policy at any meeting of editors or editors and reporters. You did not come in during the Iraq War and say, what a schmuck, I can't believe you don't talk that way. No, you're there to figure out what's going on, to make, you know, to write a good story about it, and that's it. And, you know, if anybody felt romantically thrilled that Obama spoke beautifully, people didn't talk about it. It was inappropriate. Ever since Trump's, people in the newsroom do not feel inhibited to say, holy shit. And so something has absolutely changed with this election. Absolutely. But it may not change anything.
But one of the senses is that you get this repeated, and I think this is to some extent what Jeff is speaking about, which is we get these series of episodes, right? And where the press still thinks there's a consensus that this is out of bounds, right? I mean, that meaning we as the press, haven't shaken our sense that there is a consensus where there doesn't seem to be a consensus. And maybe the question is, do you start writing about that more?
Well, I think that's being written about. I mean, that's the sort of flyover versus the coastal elite story that you hear a lot. You know, and the Washington establishment, the establishment, the global versus the ordinary person who likes the fact that he's sticking it to them, and that it's not actually a Republican Democrat, it's him against everybody, and we're on his side. So I think that's being written about a lot. Where it takes you is a little unclear.
Okay, I think we're done. That was great. Thank you so
much. Thank you guys
much.
Very much.
Thank you.